Gary Knoll. Today we're going to have two themes, a short theme at the beginning, but then a longer theme for the majority of our program. The longer theme from Japan will be James Corbett. And James has done the most important work I have seen in my career, trying to break down into lay language the Federal Reserve, our central banking system. And that way we can see, how do we get in this mess? How is it that all the best and brightest minds at the Federal Reserve and the banking system and Wall Street, how did they not see the last crash coming? How did they not see the bubble and the burst of the dot-com phenomena in 2000? Where were they this time around? Why is it that we had so few regular people getting bailed out, and yet we had a tremendous amount of money, over $16 trillion at no interest, that went to the very people who created the crisis to begin with? That just doesn't make any sense. And yet they're the people who all along have always been first in line. And there's nothing left for the small businesses. There's nothing left for the people who lost their homes. How is that possible? He will address that. But before then, I want to give you what I consider the perfect storm that's happening. Right now, we have more than 20 million college graduates who cannot afford to pay their student loans. And the interest is compounding. So a $40,000 student loan could end up being $120,000 if they don't pay it. But on the one hand, Americans are so deep in debt that we've actually made credit cards a part of our gross domestic product, meaning our income. The gross domestic product should be income that we make that's disposable income or savings. It shouldn't be debt, because what kind of economic alchemy says that debt is an asset? Well, if you're using debt to buy a corporation, then you got the value of the corporation. But what if the debt exceeds that? Have you noticed how many of the major chains have closed over the last, let's say, 5 or 6 years, like Linen and Things, Circuit City, and over 10,000 others? Why'd they close? It wasn't because they were poorly run or managed. It wasn't because they weren't making a profit. It was because at some point, equity partners went in there and made them a deal they couldn't refuse. Let's say that you were a shareholder in one of these corporations, and you were a big shareholder. You owned millions of shares, worth billions of dollars. And suddenly someone says, well, your stock is languishing at $20. We'll give you $23 a share. Now there's a big financial incentive, a profit incentive, to say, yes, go ahead. You don't question how they're doing the deal. You're just looking at the benefits you get. But let's say that you're not a publicly traded, you're a private company, and you've had this in your family for 100 years, and you've given gainful employment at a living wage to hundreds or thousands of people that work for you, and it's been passed down generation to generation. Well, guess which generation almost never sells? The one that creates the product, the service, the brand to begin with. But guess who generally does sell? Some grandchild down the road that has, in effect, been living as a trust baby and had never to invest anything, neither time nor interest, but benefited from it. So now you say your company is worth $20 million net. We'll give you $50 million. Well, that's a big incentive to walk away. So what happens is either companies are very well run and are very profitable but have no debt, and boy, those are perfect to pick up. And here's how it works. These companies partner with Wall Street banks that offer the bridge capital to actually buy it. And these people take every nickel that comes in, and instead of putting it back into the company, instead of reducing down the debt, they take that as commissions and management fees, so you actually increase the debt. Now, in good times, when everything is prosperous, you can hang on for about 7 years and 3 months. Used to be. Now it's down to 5 years before you collapse into bankruptcy. But not to worry, since the people who came in and took over the company are going to be first in line at bankruptcy, they get to buy the bankrupt company, get rid of all the debt, and start it over or resell it. So they're picking the final little piece of meat off the bone in that carcass. It's called equity partnering. These are the partnerships. Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's old company, was one of them. But let's say that you're able to withstand that until a time that someone says, we can't pay the service on our debt. So now you start downsizing. You lay off employees. And what is it that you really want at the end of the day? What's the value? The physical building, the mortar and brick building? No, it's not. There are carcasses of those shopping malls and centers and manufacturing plants all over. Yesterday, I just walked on the High Line. That's the old railroad tracks that were abandoned, and two very innovative people came into the area, and they made them reclaim that whole area along with the city, and now it's a beautiful park. You can walk from almost a mile and a half, and you get to see parts of the city you wouldn't see. But as I'm walking up this beautiful, you know, park over tracks that they had concreted over with all this foliage, trees and shrubs and wildflowers, here were all these buildings that used to be the printing capital of the world. All gone. These are all been taken over because that industry died and goes clear up almost to the garment industry, and which also is substantially reduced from what it once was. And so there's always change. Well, these people, they thrive on taking a brand. So it isn't the building they care about. It's not the workers they care about. It's the brand, because we are brand-oriented in the United States. So they take the brand, like Linens and Things, or they'll take, you know, Circuit City, and they'll take that to China. Why? Because why pay an American or a union laborer, you know, $30, $40 an hour, plus health insurance, plus all these rules and environmental regulations, OSHA requirements, and workman's compensation and overtime, when you can take this to China, and there's a gigantic corporation there, and you can go right in there and have your product made, and you don't have to worry about anything, because the Chinese government, they allow their corporations to barely pay people, no environmental problems. So now you can import a bicycle, a sewing machine, a washing machine, a couch that had historically been made in America. You can bring all that back in, and you can sell it for less than what it costs to make in the United States. So how someone in the United States making a dress at the Ladies International Garment Work, and let's just say hypothetically they're making $35 an hour, which is a living wage, and how they're going to compete with a woman who's making the same identical dress in Bangladesh for 14 cents an hour. They can have that dress made, and they did last year 900 million of them, bring it back in, and they can retail it in a box store for less than what the woman can actually make it. Well, you can't compete because you can't make a dress and sell it for a profit. Why would someone buy your dress, same identical dress, made in New York for $100 when they can buy it in a box store for $35? So that's how it works, and that's what's caused the decimation of the American workforce, the loss of tens of thousands of factories going closed, 52,000 factories closed since 2000, and all those millions of workers with them having to be absorbed at other jobs, but not as good as they once had. So you see, that's part of the perfect storm. We have an official unemployment rate of 4.8, but a real unemployment rate around 24% to 28%. We have people working two jobs and not even making the amount they used to make with one. We have people working just a few hours a week. So we have a lot of working poor in the United States, and they're not given any benefits. Their future is up to them because no one's helping them. But all the help goes to the people who are in charge. The Wall Street titans, the hedge fund managers, the equity partnerships, the head of the banks. And they made sure that they're taken care of if anything goes wrong, because they paid to have lobbyists lobbying on their behalf in Washington. Could you imagine the Secretary of Treasuries, Timothy Geithner, Lawrence Summers, Robert Rubin? They all came from Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, most of them. So guess whose interest is taken care of and protected? Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo. But not yours and I. So we are at the back of the list. It's our streets that will not be improved. It's our homes that will not be protected. It's our infrastructure that will remain decayed, all because of greed and hubris. And this is the story they will not tell. The media that they control and own will not tell us who's responsible for the decline and fall of the standard of living in the United States and loss of jobs. Now we're going to Japan by Skype. And in Japan is James Corbett. He is founder and editor of the Corbett Report, a website he started in 2007 to provide critical analysis on politics, society, economics, and history. He's written and recorded and hosted thousands of hours of audio and video, which has brought him to the attention of major independent media, such as RT. He is also host of Eye Opener on BoilingFrogs.com, and he has been also on Global Research in Canada. And he has done some very important documentaries, including How Big Oil Conquered the World and his Century of Enslavement, which is perhaps the best film exposing the dark history and corruption of the Federal Reserve System. His website, with his numerous podcasts, audio and video, is Corbett, that's C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Nice to have you with us today, James.
Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
James, before we begin on your historical journey, I'd like, if you would please, to take a look back at how we got here, but this in context first. People have no idea how much debt we have. We only hear about how rich we are, how successful we are, how much money major corporations are making, how our unemployment is only 4.4% and getting lower, how those who can afford yachts now can afford the most expensive yacht in history, a 620-foot yacht. It's larger than a cruise ship. That's just for one person. And airplanes that are huge, so big they can't even land in many airports. And $100 million apartments are now common in New York on the south of Central Park. There are 6 different billionaire buildings now. Just a year ago, there was one. And so we hear about extravagance. So you would think that we are loaded. In fact, yesterday, I walked downtown, and it's called the Skyline. It's an old abandoned railroad track that a couple guys decided to turn into a beautiful park, walking park. And you get to see Manhattan, and I was counting how many new buildings there are. And there's over 100 new buildings. I'm talking about major buildings. From down there up to about 72nd Street, the largest concentration of new, major, very expensive buildings. In fact, I was calling some of the buildings asking how much is a small apartment. Well, you add $1 million per bedroom. So if it's a 4-bedroom, it's $4 million. But some of the places went as high as $8 million. So who's got that kind of money? I mean, you're talking about 100 buildings with at least 100 to 200 apartments per building, some more. So you're talking about tens of thousands of people who are going to have a lot of money to buy these things, and yet they're going up very fast. I took a look at the debt. Now, here's what I found, and these are government statistics, James. The current gross domestic product, that's the total amount of all of our income, is $18.9 trillion. However, the U.S. total debt, this is the U.S., is $68.7 trillion. Our national debt is $19.8 trillion. The U.S. federal spending is about $4 trillion. And then we look at the local debt that communities have, and it's $1.9 trillion, and they cannot pay for this. Then you have the total interest paid each year on the debt is $2.5 trillion. Someone's making that. And our total personal debt, what we as 330 million Americans owe, is $18 trillion. Our mortgage debt, which is separate from that, is $14 trillion. Our student loan debt is $1.4 trillion. Our credit card debt, $1 trillion. And then we have unfunded liabilities, $106 trillion. And the unemployment rate, the shadow statistics, is 23% minimum. The official is 4.8. We have 150 million people who are in the U.S. workforce. That's according to Pew Research. We have 10.8 millionaires. 10.8 million millionaires. And that's excluding their property. We have 61.6 million in professional careers, of which 17.2 million are young. And that's from the Department of Professional Employees. So when you look at all the people who have this money, some have real money. That would be the millionaires. The professional class, lawyers, doctors, engineers, architects, professors, CPAs, and scientists, they make anywhere between 100 to, let's say, 700,000 a year. With four people per family, they're the ones who believe that they should be living like millionaires, but they have to borrow. They're in debt up to their eyeballs. So how many doctors continue to tell us that we need a procedure we may not, and give us more expensive procedures, which could be helping to pay for their lifestyle or their kids' Ivy League education? So when I'm looking at this, here we are, the United States, condemning Greece with a 300% debt to their gross domestic product. Italy and France and other countries in the European Union, Ireland, somewhere between 150 to 300%. And yet I'm adding up, and we've got almost $170 trillion in debt that can never be repaid against $18 trillion in income. That makes us, quite simply, just look at the math. It's not political. We are the most indebted nation in the world per capita. We can't get out of it, and yet we're deciding the economic policy for the world. To me, this makes no sense. How did we get here? Take your time. What role does the Federal Reserve play in it? The forum is yours.
Well, thank you for that wide-ranging introduction. You opened up a Pandora's box of issues that are all, as you paint there quite vividly, I think quite interconnected, but it seems quite confusing. There's so many different terms and so many different things that are going on. But I think the central point of what you bring up is the debt. It all comes back down to the issue of indebtedness. And you point to the debt, which if you go to usdebtclock.org, as we're recording this conversation, we're getting very close to that $20 trillion mark for the U.S. government total national debt, which is a stunning figure by any calculation. And of course, the federal spending is 3.9 trillion, about 4 trillion, and federal tax revenue is 3.3 trillion. So that national debt is going up by $600 billion a year at minimum, which again is a stunning, there's just so many of these stunningly large figures that tend to bedazzle us. I think when we think about debt, however, at our rung of the economic ladder, the average working person thinks of it in terms of you are in debt or you are not in debt. So either your total assets versus liabilities is in a state of indebtedness, you actually owe money to the banks for your mortgage or your car or what have you, or you're debt free. But there's actually a third state to be in, not just being in debt or being out of debt, but actually being the person who issues the credit. That is the real linchpin of the economy, because the real point of the entire monetary system, the way it has come together, is that money is based on debt. New money is created in the economy, with the exception of coins, which represent a tiny sliver of a fraction of the economy, but the vast majority of the economy is itself debt-based money. Without debt, if you were to retire all of the personal and national debt in the United States, for example, there would essentially be no money left for anyone, because the system itself is based on money. And that's something that most people don't really have their heads wrapped around, because, again, at our at the average working person's level of the economy, they never really have to encounter the fundamental question of what is money and where does it come from and who issues it and under what conditions and how do they profit from that. And that is really ultimately what this issue of the Federal Reserve is about, because we talk about the Federal Reserve, and at this point I would imagine most Americans have at least heard of the Federal Reserve. They've certainly seen the Federal Reserve system stamp on their dollar bills and what have you. They've seen it written. They know vaguely that it's a central bank of some sort, but they don't really understand what it is or how it came to be. And I think so in order to understand, well, what is the central bank? What does it do? It does serve us to understand where the concept of this central banking comes from. And the real first central bank in the vein of what we understand today was developed in Amsterdam in the 17th century. But the first central bank in the United States was specifically modeled on was the Bank of England, which came together in 1694 for a very specific reason and under a very specific historical set of events. Namely, the Nine Years' War was raging in Europe. It was Louis XIV of France, basically against the rest of Europe. And King William III of England was fighting heavily against the French and was devastated by a naval defeat that he was not expecting, and has committed his court to rebuilding the English Navy. But he doesn't have the credit for it. His coffers have been exhausted, and the banks are not so the bankers are not so happy about the idea of lending more money to this to the crown when he seems to be destroying the nation and the capital, and it all seems to be going downhill. So the bankers are quite reticent. So a banker comes up with a solution, namely, why don't we create this new bank? We'll call it the Bank of England to make it sound like a government entity, even though it's a private bank. It's a company, and it will lend £1 million to the crown, to King William, at 6%, and a £5,000 management fee on top, with the right to issue the notes, i.e. issue bank notes that actually work as money in the British economy, the English economy at that time. And so, of course, King William goes for it, and he says, okay. And the details change a little bit between the initial proposal. Ultimately, ends up being a £1.2 million loan. It's at 8%. They get £4,000 management expense. But that is the model of how this first central bank came together, and they call it the Bank of England, even though it is not actually owned by the crown. It is a private company that has been created for the purpose of lending money to the crown. And the interesting part is that the owners of that, the people who invested in that company, actually had to put up a certain amount of capital. But in fact, they'd loaned themselves the capital to do that through their own bank. So the actual money to create the bank didn't exist until the bank was created. It's a wild story, but it really was the model, specifically the model upon which the first central bank of the United States, at any rate, the Continental Congress at that time in the 1780s was created. There was a problem with the revolutionaries trying to fund the Revolutionary War against the British were trying to find a way to keep their soldiers clothed and fed and armed and provisioned. So they had to issue their own currency. They called it the Continental. And as people might know, the term may have survived in term, oh, it's not worth a continental. The continental became worthless because it was overissued. They printed too much of it. The British had an entire counterfeiting operation to try to undermine the currency, and eventually it became useless. So they got together and they chartered a bank called the Bank of North America to be a central bank to basically oversee the debt of the newly founded United States. And they specifically modeled it on that idea of the Bank of England. The Bank of England came into being loaning £1.2 million to the crown. The Bank of North America came into being loaning $1.2 million to Congress. It was essentially the same deal. By the end of the war, once the United States had really been established, the idea of a central bank like that didn't seem to make sense to the people. Why do we need this? We're not funding a war at this point. We're not on a war footing. We don't need this entity. So the Bank of North America gets downgraded into just a regular private commercial bank chartered by the state of Pennsylvania and is no longer a central bank. But that's the idea. And that idea is picked up on by, of course, Alexander Hamilton, who says that, he is the first Treasury Secretary under President Washington, of course, and he thinks this will be a great idea. What we need is to create a national debt, and secure that national debt through taxation. This is the way we're going to found the country. This is the way we're going to build up a great industrial base. This is the way we're going to make America great for the first time, I suppose, if he was trying to put something on a red cap for a presidential run. I'm sure that would be it, to make America great. So that was his idea. We need a national debt. We're going to secure it through this bank that we're going to create. We're going to create a central bank. Now, Jefferson and Madison are quite opposed to this. Thomas Jefferson, writing quite scathing and eloquent exposés of this idea of a national debt, of a central bank. He says, "The spirit of war and indictment since the modern theory of the perpetuation of debt has drenched the earth with blood and crushed its inhabitants under burdens ever accumulating." But ultimately, Hamilton won that debate. He got the ear of Washington, and the first Bank of the United States was chartered in 1791, again, to secure that debt of the national government and to operate it. But again, as a private entity, it had private shareholders, including some actual Englishmen, which is kind of ironic, considering, of course, they had just fought this great Revolutionary War to become an independent nation, but they have Englishmen securing the debt of the newly founded United States. Isn't that a bit strange? And a lot of people did find that strange. And there was it did start to enter the political debate right away. Why do we need this? What terms is it operating under? Who are these shareholders that are holding this debt that the government is paying off? How did this come about? It becomes a political issue. In 1811, by that point, the nation is off the ground and people think, well, we don't need this central bank anymore. So it actually, the charter expires and is not renewed. And there goes the first Bank of the United States. Immediately, the U.S. gets into war again, a war with England, of course, the War of 1812. And once again, war is the necessity of, well, we need more money, we need more credit in order to supply the troops and keep everything flowing. So the public debt of the U.S. mushrooms at that point from $45.2 million to $119.2 million, which, of course, in 1812 time period is quite a lot of money. And so in order, again, to secure the debt and to fund the operations of the government, they form another central bank in 1816, the Second Bank of the United States. Again, it's on a 20-year charter. And again, by the 1830s, when the charter is up for renewal, suddenly President Jackson is in power. And so the bankers sense this might not be so popular. Let's move up the renewal of the charter from 1836 to 1832. We'll try to get it in at the pass in the changeover of power. Certainly a new president is not going to, newly sitting in office, is not going to try to challenge this, you know, now longstanding U.S. institution. But of course, Jackson does exactly that. He vetoes the renewal charter and stakes his 1836 re-election on, I'm sorry, his 1832 re-election on the idea of no bank. We will not have a Bank of the United States, a central bank. He wrote at that time in his veto message, he says, "Whatever interest or influence, whether public or private, has given birth to this act, the renewal charter of the bank, that is, it cannot be found either in the wishes or necessities of the executive department, by which present action is deemed premature, and the powers conferred upon its agents not only unnecessary, but dangerous to the government and country. It is to be regretted that the rich and powerful too often bend the acts of government to their selfish purposes. If we cannot at once, in justice to interests vested under improvident legislation, make our government what it ought to be, we can at least take a stand against all new grants of monopolies and exclusive privileges, against any prostitution of our government to the advancement of the few at the expense of the many, and in favor of compromise and gradual reform in our code of laws and system of political economy." And just to underscore the fact that Jackson hated the banks, he actually made his presidential reelection slogan, "Jackson and no banks." and Jackson and no bank. Obviously referring to the Second Bank of the United States. And he won the election, and he followed through, and he ended the Second Bank of the United States. By 1835, the United States had paid off its national debt for the first and only time in its entire history. And in 1836, the Second Bank of the United States charter expired, and the bank went into the dustbin of history. So at that point, there was a 77-year gap between the end of the Second Bank of the United States and the formation of the Federal Reserve System. And in that space, there is, it's called the free banking era, but there's various acts of Congress that are passed. There are various systems and institutions that spring up in that time, which is worth an entire study into in itself. But the central point is there is no quote unquote central bank that operates in the way the Bank of North America or the First Bank of the United States or the Second Bank of the United States operated, as that central institution that secures the credit of the country and issues the national banknotes. But by 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act is passed, a new crisis has come along. And I think this is the important thing to understand, is that the 1694, the original passage of the Bank of England, and as well as the Bank of North America, the First Bank of the United States, the Second Bank of the United States, those were all created during times of crisis, specifically in order to secure emergency credit to make sure that the funds continued to flow for emergency operations, generally war. But in the case of 1913, the United States was in a different form of panic, a financial panic that was brought about by these cyclical runs and panics and crashes that were happening on Wall Street at least every decade between the end of the Second Bank of the United States in 1836 and the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913. There was major crisis at some point. And in 1907, there was a particularly bad panic, essentially equivalent to something like the 2008 meltdown, that brought the entire financial system to the brink of collapse. And as always, it was these Wall Street bankers that were playing hard and fast with the rules and playing essentially with the entire nation's ability to function. They had grown so large and so powerful that if these banks, these Wall Street banks, really did teeter and fall, it would bring the nation down with them. And everyone recognized this. Everyone hated the Wall Street institutions in a way that's maybe even hard to fathom in our day and age, even though that's not exactly an uncommon sentiment now. But yeah, as much as the Occupy Wall Street idea occupies people's minds in our day and age, it was a central issue in that time. And people recognized that the Wall Street banks had too much power. And basically, J.P. Morgan did some deals with some other bankers and managed to, quote unquote, save Wall Street from itself, essentially. But everyone knew, well, we need to stop this. We need a way to get these bankers under control. We need to regulate what they're doing. We need some governmental function, something that we have a say in, a stake in, that we can put ourselves between ourselves and that banking system that could crush us. So the momentum, the political momentum behind the idea of the creation of a new central bank that would be run and controlled by the government to basically chain and muzzle the bankers so that they won't play hard and fast with the nation's lifeblood, was so overwhelming that there was no doubt that there was something was going to occur from this. So you have these hearings that are brought to basically examine the Wall Street bankers and, you know, drag their dirty laundry out into the public and show what's going on in Wall Street and how these banks are making their money. These investigations are being followed in day to day in the newspapers. Everyone's talking about it. The banking industry and how it's run and the effects that it has is on the tip of everyone's tongue. This is the era of people, entire political movements that were springing up on the idea of money and who governs it and who should be able to issue it and should silver be money and things like this. And you have William Jennings Bryan, "We will not be nailed upon the cross of gold," and all of this political language was being framed around this debate of the banks. So it was into that midst that the bankers, of course, seeing this and realizing, well, something is going to happen here. There is going to be some sort of regulatory body that's put in place. Why don't we basically get ahead of it and create it ourselves so that we can essentially govern ourselves, as we've already been doing, but in this time with the imprimatur of government? And that is precisely what occurred. So for people who don't know, in 1910, basically some of the most influential bankers in the United States got together with Senator Nelson Aldrich, who was a very influential senator on the Finance Committee at that time. who essentially had the purse strings of the United States and was extremely important in the Senate at that time, they got together to hammer out what essentially became the Federal Reserve Act. And they did so, of course, in complete and utter secrecy, because as one of the conspirators admitted 25 years after the fact in the Saturday Evening Post when he was writing about it decades later, he said, "We were absolutely certain to make sure that we were not discovered, because if the public found out that we were the ones who were planning this, of course they wouldn't go for it." Now, the somewhat irony here is that from that meeting, they come up with this idea for a central bank that they essentially would run and own and control, that would issue the money of the nation, but and control, quote unquote, the bankers, but which would really be run by them. They came up with this plan. It was the Aldrich plan. And of course, Nelson Aldrich took it back to the Senate and tried to get it passed. And ultimately, it failed. But the plan basically got revised a little bit here and there and taken up by a couple of other members of Congress and was eventually passed in 1913. So essentially, the Federal Reserve Act did come from that secret meeting, which was the bankers conspiring about how to, quote unquote, regulate themselves. Does this sound familiar to anyone? And that is the kernel, the basis for the Federal Reserve system, where it comes from. And that's how we have to understand this system. Now, when you get into the question of ownership, who owns the Federal Reserve is a common question that people like to ask. But it's not so much about ownership. They purposefully made this institution somewhat difficult to somewhat opaque in terms of its structure. Technically, it's broken into three branches. You have the Board of Governors, which is appointed by the president and Congress. So it does have that governmental imprimatur on it. But it also has these regional reserve banks, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, etc. There's 12 of these regional banks. And those banks are, in fact, private corporations that are owned essentially by the member banks themselves. They are shareholders in those regional banks. And then the third branch of the Federal Reserve the Federal Reserve system is the Federal Open Market Committee, which consists of some member the Board of Governors, but also some of the directors of those private Federal Reserve regional banks. And they together set the monetary policy for the United States. They are the ones that when they say the Fed raised interest rates, or the Fed lowered interest rates, which is a bit of an obfuscation in of itself. But at any rate, when they say that, they are saying essentially these private bankers and some of their cronies who have been appointed by the president are the ones that are basically controlling the fundamental lever of the economy, the interest rates, which relates to, of course, the supply of money, which relates to inflation, which relates to employment. All of this stems from the decisions of the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee. So it, rather than a question of ownership, who owns the Federal Reserve System, it is the question of control. Who controls the Federal Reserve System and, as a result, the economy itself? And the answer is essentially it is the bankers themselves that are running the entire economy. And they are the ones who are creating the debt, which is itself the money that we refer to. When we talk about money, we are generally talking about debt that is created by bankers and owed back to the banks at interest to the banks. It's a great job if you're a banker, in which you get to create money essentially out of nothing, out of people's promises to pay, essentially, and you get to charge interest on that. And you make money whether the economy's expanding, everything's going well, you're giving lots of credit, there's lots of people taking credit, there's lots of loans being created, lots of money being created, which means more people are going to be paying you back eventually. Or if the economy is contracting, well, all those people who fall off the debt treadmill and get their goods repossessed or get their mortgage foreclosed, you get to scoop up all those physical assets. So you get to control more of the economy as a percentage. So as a banker, you win no matter whether the economy is expanding or contracting. And of course, if you can manipulate the money supply itself, you can basically play it like an accordion, and you can have these great big booms in which everything's going all great and everyone's getting into debt to you. And then you have the bust and you get to collect all the actual assets, scoop them up off the table and start it again. And that is essentially the system as it functions. Now, even if that were the only base part of this, I suppose there would be at least some institutional stability to that, insofar as the bankers themselves would have a vested interest in making sure that the entire thing didn't go belly up. They'd at least want to see that game continue to play out, because they obviously profit at it from every turn. But the other part of this is that if there is ever a systemic problem, like what we saw in 2008, well, of course, they are the ones who are ultimately deciding what the government is going to do, how the government is going to solve this, by creating more debt and paying it to them. So they actually are incentivized to create these kinds of crises. At any rate, they certainly are not penalized from them. And as we saw from the 2008 crisis, the ultimate end result of that was trillions of dollars in emergency lending and emergency bailout funds that were directed to the banks of the bankers who were sitting on the Federal Reserve regional bank boards that were deciding where these funds were going to go and directing them to their own banks. It's a swindle at absolutely every level, and all the more effective because not one person in 100 in the United States even has any inkling of a clue that this is how it actually works.
I appreciate the overview. Now, a few short answers. When we see that there was quantitative easing, which was in effect the Federal Reserve and the Treasury giving upwards of $80 billion a month in interest-free loans that these banks could use any way they wanted, did that help small businesses? Did it protect any of the people whose mortgages were underwater? Did it help build new factories? Did it de-ghettoize an area? Did it help anyone except for the bankers?
No, it did not, precisely because what quantitative easing was targeting specifically was longer-term bonds and mortgage-backed securities. And specifically, essentially, what the government was doing, or what the Federal Reserve was doing with the imprimatur of government, was saying to all of the financial institutions, the investment banks that had created this crazy casino that ended up melting down, they were saying, okay, all of those absolutely insane things, the investments that you cooked up, and that the investment agencies, by the way, gave AAA credit ratings to, which basically sealed the deal and completed the circle to allow this entire swindle to take place, we're going to backstop that and make sure none of you actually feel the effects of that. And that's essentially what quantitative easing was about. And of course, one of the knockoff effects of quantitative easing is that it has created a massive stock boom. In fact, a recent evaluation that I believe came out last year calculated that 96% of the increase in the Dow and S&P over the period of the last 8 years has been directly attributable to that that boom from the Fed, the quantitative easing. So it has had a knock-on effect on the economy generally, and a rising stock market generally portends rising valuations, which generally means rising shareholder dividends and knock-on effects through the economy. So in some kind of third or fourth order way, you could say that this has created some boon to Main Street, as it were, although not as much as usual, actually, because in recent years, actual mom and pop investors have slipped down below 50% of the overall stock market in the United States. So for the first time, I think, in history, the vast majority of holders of stock are, in fact, institutional investors. So not even those kinds of dividends are actually trickling down as much as they used to. But at some point, at any rate, things didn't melt down as bad as they would have if the financial system had completely seized. So everyone thinks, well, I mean, it could have been worse. It didn't. It kind of avoided tragedy. But that obscures the point that the real and absolute base level of this bailout and what it accomplished was not just the saving of given financial institutions, but really lifting them into record profits. I mean, it has to be kept in mind that in the years directly preceding this, as a direct result of this emergency lending and these bailouts and the extra incentivization for these financial institutions to park their reserves at the Fed, they actually received dividends in the form of record profits, which is, again, total madness, the absolute opposite of what should have happened in anything resembling a system of justice. But that is ultimately what ended up accruing. And I think the scale of the profits that have accrued to the very institutions that created the mess versus the I suppose you could say, slight trickle-down kind of effects that may have benefited some people on Main Street. That discrepancy really needs to be looked at twice or three or four times, especially because that stock market bubble that's been run up as a result of the quantitative easing boom is inevitably going to pop at some point. And when that happens, I think we'll really see what the effects of this quantitative easing era was all about.
We have a duopoly here. We have both parties supporting the banks, supporting the Federal Reserve, supporting their chairman, supporting the Treasury Secretary. It doesn't matter whether it's conservative or liberal who are in power. They're all in it together. But we also, at the same time, have over 240 million Americans who are struggling, who cannot go 2 weeks without pay, and they would be insolvent. We have an actual homeless rate of almost 28 million Americans. We're only counting people who are officially in shelters, and that's a tiny, tiny percentage of the people. We're not looking at the bubble in the equity market. It's being recommended, get your money into the stock market. It's just going to keep going up. We're not looking at the bubble in student loans, car payments, credit cards, or now they've reinflated the real estate market just in California. In one county, property values went from an average home, not your mansions, not your big condos, just regular homes, from around $247,000 up to almost $700,000, a huge increase. You know, you're talking about almost 150% increase. Normally, it's 1% per year. And here we have just in the last 4 years. So we're living in a bubble economy. Then we have this phenomenon. I was speaking with someone I know who is a professional, and they said that they are up to their eyeballs in debt because they want their kids to go to Ivy League schools, and they had to put them in private schools, and they want to show appearances. And this person said, I can't tell you the stress I live under every day, because I don't know when I'm going to be able to make the payments and how much I can make. So that's not the only person who is living beyond their means, all encouraged by this. Then we get a Ron Paul, Bernie Sanders, audit the Fed, and we find out that Goldman Sachs got $800 billion, that Citicorp got $2.2 trillion, and the Bank of America got over $2 trillion. All added up, it was over $16 trillion, all in secret. None of this was made public, that they got, but we didn't get anything. We didn't get money for infrastructure. We got nothing. No universal health care. So my final question for you is this. Corporate America is trillions of dollars into debt. We have one monopoly after another. One trust after another, one big corporation buying another big corporation, or merging. Like, you know, right now it's Time Warner who's buying Time Warner? Comcast. And so when you look at the mergers, well, the bigger the merger, the less competition. So it's becoming more and more difficult for a small person to stay in business. When I was walking downtown yesterday, I counted dozens and dozens of closed stores. No one's talking about the loss of all these businesses that have been there, some for decades, and the employees that work there, and what it meant to the neighborhood, the malling of America. On the Upper West Side, you have all the banks and drug stores and mall stores, but where are the mom-and-pop stores? They can't afford the rent. So we're not looking at the fundamentals. We're being told the fundamentals are fine. You can't have this many people out of work. You can't have 96 million people minimally, according to the government, out of work or part-time working, and then say you've got a 4.8% unemployment rate. No, you got between a 25 and 28% unemployment rate. You can't say that the economy is really booming and have over 100 million Americans who don't have $500 that they could put their hands on in any given week. You don't have 48 million people on food stamps, and you have over one-third of all homeowners who are now underwater in their mortgages. You don't have the highest rent that we've ever seen in homes in America, taking up to 50% of a person's total income, when above 30% is considered dangerous, and say that you're stable. Corporations are deep into debt, and that they're given more debt. And at the same time, we have more derivatives, $426 trillion in derivatives from just five banks, and no one's even talking about it. The average American doesn't know what a derivative is, and yet we, the American taxpayer, will have to bail these people out, as we did when we bailed out AIG, and Goldman Sachs made billions of dollars in profits, made more money than what they actually invested in it. That was the deal that was made. So could you make sense of this idea that we're being told one thing when in reality we're bankrupt?
Well, I think it makes perfect sense of why the economic reality can never really be outwardly stated, is because it has reached a point at which we are looking at world historical levels. When you look throughout history, the income inequality argument generally is identifying something, but generally populations throughout history have been able to live with a degree of economic inequality between the people at the bottom and the people at the top, so long as the inequality is not so great, and also the idea of elasticity, that you can move up that ladder, or some of the people at the top may come down that ladder, and there's some elasticity in that. When you reach this level where you have hundreds of millions of people that are now clinging on for dear life into the middle class or even the working poor, then there clearly is a point at which you start to reach French revolutionary type levels, where the peasants literally simply cannot pay their seigniorage and ultimately end up chopping the king's head off. I think we are coming towards that level of inequality and that sort of institutional level. But I think the better way to frame that, rather than simply inequality, is centralization versus decentralization. And I think what we are experiencing is the end result of a system that itself is predicated on centralization. Central banks that centrally direct interest rates that pertain throughout the economy, because everything's wedded into this Federal Reserve system, and that essentially is central coordination. And the closer you are to those central coordinating bodies, either as a bank that is a member of the Federal Reserve system or as a major corporate conglomerate that has direct access to that spigot of credit, you are going to be the beneficiaries of that. And the people further down that ladder are basically never going to experience the good effects of it, if you will. And that centralization just gets more and more and more and more consolidated into fewer and fewer hands until you reach the point that we're living at right now. Of course, the real point of this world historical revolutionary time that we're living through is, well, then what happens on the other side? What are people motivated by, and what should they actually be looking for out of this? And I think if what we are experiencing is the ultimate logical extension of centralization, then clearly decentralization, disintermediation of this system of control in a very few hands that are controlling entire industries, entire economies, clearly has to change. And amazingly enough, we are also living through world historical revolutionary times in terms of the technology that would allow, for the first time in human history, the true disintermediation of that financial system into the hands of everyday people. Right now, through peer-to-peer technologies, decentralization and disintermediation of every function of the banking system, at least every major function that the average working person would need to access, is in people's hands right now, is actually functioning. There, you can decentralize and disintermediate deposits and loans and funds transfers, international funds transfers if necessary, and foreign currency exchanges. All of this is being done through various peer-to-peer technologies that really truly do threaten to make the banking system as it exists irrelevant, which is a really mind-boggling idea. But once again, not one person in 100 really knows of all of these opportunities, let alone understands that this represents the opposite to the direction that we've been going in, and the sort of base of the problems that we're living through. So the other possibility, of course, is that we do go through some sort of maybe a French revolutionary redux, where people take their anger out on a certain political target or on certain banking interests that they see as the problem, only to reinstitute a system that ultimately leads us to the same spot or even worse. So I think that's really what we're living through right now, is a battle for the soul of where this is going, because clearly the hundreds of millions of people in the United States and billions around the world, ultimately, who are being squeezed, trying to, as the bankers basically try to squeeze blood from the stone, at a certain point that will change, that will revolt, that will lead to revolution. But the question is, what will that revolution look like and what will emerge on the other side?
Very much appreciate you being on, James, and sharing these insights on the Federal Reserve and our banking system and the role of debt. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
And James Corbett's website is corbettreport.com, where you can get all of his information, and there's a lot of it. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.